back with the Geek Whisperers. I'm Amy Lewis.
I'm John Mark Troyer.
And I'm Matt Brender.
So we are kicking off a most excellent podcast because we have really a friend of the podcast. And if you don't know him yet, we're excited to introduce you to him. Chris Wall is on with us today. We think we might call this Interview with a Unicorn. So Chris, with that kind of introduction, tell us about yourself.
And I feel like I'm among kindred spirits, being that I've always coined the phrase virtualization whisperer for myself. we're just all whispering. So I love it. Yeah.
So, and just to tell the listeners, so Chris is a listener and actually got in touch with us and said, "Hey, I've got an idea," which we always love to hear. So anybody else out there who wants to raise their hand, this is what happens. you land on the show.
You will be called on.
It's a huge ego. Yeah.
So we've got a number of things we'd love to talk to you about. We were talking sort of before we got started that we feel like we've got a little bit of a mini series within our show where we've talked to other tech practitioners who are also really well-versed in the social world. And full disclosure, I got to know Chris a bit last year. He served as roving reporter at Cisco Live, which is kind of a cool project we've got where somebody who is not from Cisco comes and does reporting, a la Kermit the Frog, on site to kind of give us a geek's eye view of what's happening and from a non-Cisco voice, which is something that we think is pretty interesting. So if you can't come to the show, or even if you can, you can get a perspective on it. So that's the kind of things, Chris, I think you're known for. Do you want to, tell us some more about what you do during the day, what led you here?
Yeah, it really depends on who's listening. So if anyone at my day job is listening, throughout the day, I work hard and bill hours to my clients. but for the most part, I write, I blog, I like to go to conferences and talk to people. And I'm fortunate enough that a lot of vendors are willing to help me pay for that or completely pay for that. So I'm very blessed.
So, I mean, Chris, let me jump in here. You work for a consulting company. Is your company and okay with you being sent to a conference and, like, say, for instance, we, like Amy described, having Cisco pay for it?
Yeah, for the most part, they're pretty cool about letting me go. You know, for the most part, I use PTO days to do this kind of stuff. So a friend of mine, Tom Hollingsworth, always said during the day he's Tom and at night he's Batman. And so basically I have my Batman pool of PTO that I use to go do this stuff. And there's sometimes overlap where it makes sense and they'll give me a nudge, like VMworld, for example. It's totally in the clear. Other stuff's a little more obscure. Perhaps it doesn't really align with, you know, what we do as a business. And for that, I just take on the responsibility myself.
That's a really interesting model because it sounds like, you're not just balancing, like, you know, home life and a personal consulting gig. You have a normal full-time job. If maybe normal might sound more pejorative than I mean, you have a place where you get a paycheck and then you're also doing these things on your paid time off from that business. How did you broker that conversation with your management? Were you hired known as the Chris Wall or did you develop while under their wing?
Yeah, that's a good question. It kind of started a little earlier than when I worked this job. I started going to conferences a little bit and writing and things like Tech Field Day. And I got bored. It's a pretty typical story. You're in the customer side. You get bored. You decide, hey, I'm going to consult for better or worse. And when we were talking about what that balance would be, you know, versus or billable work versus doing this conference, you know, fun riding the flying tube to the sky, I definitely made a point to say, you know what, this is something that makes me happy. It's a part of my professional and personal, you know, livelihood. You know, are you okay with that? And brought it right up in the front and they were perfectly fine with it. I don't think I would ever say I was like the Chris Wall. You know, I don't come in and they're like, oh, what can we do for you, sir? Here's a glass of lemon water. But it was definitely brought up. And I think that was an important aspect to say, you know, I'm going to be doing these things. Are you okay with that? And I don't know, they were pretty cool with it. And I imagine they get value out of it if someone knows who I am and they're trying to, you know, say, hey, we'd love to come in and talk to you about whatever cloud thing. And they could say, oh, we have that Chris Wall guy. He's there. And, you know, I assume that stuff happens. I really
he's
don't.
On the intertubes with you yeah. other tweeters. Yeah.
No, I keep talking to this Matt guy about his cat. It's a weird guy. You know?
But I think it's a great point of, like, you have to do it up front. You have to be clear about it. I'm curious, did you have any trouble? Did you have your pitch down? Was it hard for you to describe it? Did it make sense? Did management buy in?
Oh, that's an interesting one. A little bit. There was a little bit of confusion as to, okay, but why do you go do this stuff? I mean, what's the point? And, you know, quite frankly, it was a little hard to articulate. You know, what is the point? For the most part,
that's the great question, you know, right? That's what we're all here talking about.
Yeah, for me, it's just fun. I just love doing it. I love going to these, you know, events and talking to people and talking tech. And it's like Red Bull for the soul. And it was a little hard to articulate, but essentially what I did was just negotiated more PTO days, you know, slightly more than what was initially offered, and said, you know what, I'll just use that. And quite frankly, my thought was, I don't really want to bring the baggage of the consulting firm with me to some of these events. I want to just be me. And I felt like it was appropriate or ethical to say, if it's going to be just me and I'm not going to represent you, I'll just use paid time off. And that way, you know, they're not on the hook for it. I'm just on vacation.
Yeah, yeah. And I like that. And I think that falls right into a real core of what we hope to talk to you about today. And that is really the authenticity that you're able to bring to a really tricky balancing act of being employed and doing your job and then being paid by a vendor to go to a show. But yet everyone continues to respect your opinion. And I've got to ask, why? Why you? No.
Lots of bribery.
but how do you approach this very tenuous balancing of relationships and paychecks and opportunities as they knock on your door?
So I kind of have a list of do's and don'ts, you know, like the stop sign and the green stoplight kind of thing.
That's perfect.
And that I use to guide me through all of this. And it's pretty common sense. It's, you know, don't burn anybody, no matter who they are, whether or not we partner with them or don't, or if they sponsor the blog or don't. I really don't care. I try to make sure that everything I write is positive in some way, or at least constructive. And if I do have an issue with somebody, I take it privately. And, you know, I just don't want to burn a bridge. And the other thing is, focus on the tech, focus on, you know, what I guess the readers want, what I would want if I was reading what I was writing, and basically make sure that there's, at the end of the day, it's not opinion or FUD to the degree that it's like marketing, but that it's something that if I'm interested in it, I can always defend it. And I think that's really what it boils down to.
That makes a lot of sense. And one of the things we really wanted to touch on is, you know, how do you maintain that air of authenticity and neutrality when you're working in kind of all these different ways? And you've talked about some ways just very crisply in terms of your job with, you know, paid time off. So you're clearly one person here and one person there. You know, how do you, but I think we often, so often look at the negative side. Have you found, as this has evolved, that you have seen some, tell us about some of the positive impacts? Cause I would, and at least, again, I'm biased here in my work with you. It was an amazing thing to see all that you brought from your work experience brought into, you know, what we were doing together for your work as roving reporter, because it was just very natural. You brought your natural enthusiasm and interest and all the tech knowledge that you've gained, you know, by getting paid to do that. It's a cool concept. So you get to, you know, leverage a passion and continue to learn.
Yeah, it's I think it really matters that you like this stuff and that it's authentic, that you enjoy going and doing these kind of things, and it kind of leaks out. I hate the word leak, but there I hadn't said it. And that's when you go to these things, the positives that come out of it are the fact that it snowballs very heavily. You know, I went to, I think in 2011 I did two or three events. The next year, I think I did a dozen, and now I'm up to my max. I'm doing like 35 of these things a year. I can't do any more. And so you get a lot of access some really cool, you know, embargoed information. You get to help influence how products that you love. Like, I love a lot of this stuff. I find it really cool. So I don't think people like to say I'm agnostic about technology. That's a complete lie. There's no such thing as being technology agnostic. We all like certain things. We all like certain technologies. And if you align this kind of I'm going to go out and see what's going on in the world of tech with what you are interested in, I think it pays out in spades just because you get to offer influence towards these products and towards the technology. You get to meet a lot of cool people like the three of you and talk about, you know, some past pain points. And it just overall, it rounds you out better as, you know, as a consultant. For me, I'm a better consultant because of it. I'm more thoroughly steeped in the delicious bacon stew that is tech. And I get to ride my unicorn around and just do all that fun stuff. So it's a great experience.
I appreciate the note of including us and the idea that it's about the connections you make, but also about, I mean, I think you go to war in whatever your day job is just with more skills, more knowledge, more connections that have you more prepared for the dynamic conversation of our industry.
Yeah, I have a day job question, Chris, actually. You have a blog. You are extremely accomplished. You have a lot of certifications, including VMware's highest certification. You have a book coming out. I have some pet theories that bottom-up selling technology, selling to technologists rather than and to CIOs, but the bottom-up part of that is increasingly important, but I'm kind of invested in that. So I may be self-deluding myself, but how does the blogging makes you a better consultant? I agree, because you get all this knowledge and you're on Twitter and you have a huge peer group to feed you stuff and to talk with, and you go to all these conferences. Does it also have an impact on the selling process just from the customers? Do they know, you know, do they, have they heard of you, or have, does any part of that factor into your selling equation?
Yeah, you know what's really cool about that is I hear you talking about bottom up. I'm on the post-sale side. So I'm always working pretty much always working with admins and engineers and, you know, maybe as far up as director, but for the most part, my day-to-day work doesn't really go to the top of the pyramid, if you want to say. And so I don't know. It always sounds boastful whenever I talk about this stuff. But for the most part, when I work with the people that I'm engaged with, you know, on my day job, they have heard of the blog. Sometimes they may not really associate that with me personally. And you get to work with these people that are also interested in technology or at least can kind of cut through the crap. You know, I've read your blog. I know that you at least know a couple of things. I'm not going to give you that whole stonewall kind of engagement when you deal with somebody that's like, oh, that jerk consultant's here. I want to get this guy out of here. It's more about
you've got to prove himself. He's got to, what the hell does he know?
Yeah. Instead of beating your chest about, you know, with the stump the chump type, you know, BS, it's more about, okay, cool, let's get some work done. So it definitely helps that route. And when I talk to the sales guys, you know, because I really don't do that side of the business, they're always like, oh, yeah, everyone knows who you are. You know, it makes my life, you know, more, I can say easier, because in case someone, you know, you're, what is he saying? Sales is easy? I'm sure it's hard, but they definitely say that I get brought up a lot. So I think, at least from the bottom-up discussion, I know that it helps from my side of the business, the services and the paid consulting, you know, workshop style engagements. It makes it a lot easier if someone knows who you are, just because you can get in the door a little easier. You're not having to do, like you said, the stump the chump, you know, gorilla beating the chest type stuff. From the sales side, I don't know. To me, it's like they'll say, you know, they'll tell me this stuff and it just comes in one ear, comes out the other. It doesn't impact me. I hope that doesn't sound, you know, just, you know, I guess negative about it or anything, but, you know, I'm not really interested in how many people have heard of me and you know, what that does. I'm more interested in making sure that when I get to work with somebody that I can just skip right to the tech, and I found this helps do that, and therefore I'm happy with it.
It's actually that you can skip right to the tech. It's sort of, it's almost like relationship marketing speed dating.
I like that, though. When you think about it, I mean, we keep in casual touch with such an excellent group of technical people through Twitter, through the blogs, and John, I mean, you're a huge advocate of just the fly on the wall podcast styles that a few of our favorite people record on a regular basis, and I think it allows us to continue the sense of rapport. So that when we do get the chance to see each other in person, whether it's for work or for fun, it just feels like there's less we have to worry about catching up with up front. And I could see that being a real benefit to a business.
Yeah, we do the virtualization user podcast as a service. I love it. And it sounds like if you say whoop ass really, really quick, it sounds like whoop ass. So.
It makes me think of Wu-Tang Clan, actually.
Well, I don't think GS intended that. But
it's a new podcast, and they're talking with admins, and those are good. But also the last one I listened to actually was just yesterday in my car ride, was just you guys talking to each other, which is what Brenda was just talking about with the fly on the wall stuff. I am not an IT admin, but I swear to God, I will sit there and listen to you talk shop all day. I don't know why. Part of it's I'm paid for it, but I don't know. I just find it interesting to hear professionals talk about their job. I mean, you could be like a fireman. I think I would find it interesting.
I agree. It's there's something about people who do their job really well and getting to listen to them talk about it. It just is interesting because it's passion. You know, you're getting to hear somebody at their best.
Yep, passion is exactly the word I was going to hit on, because you just hear the excitement, the interest, you know, whether it's about a product and you don't actually like that product on the other side, it doesn't matter. It's about the passion for the study of what we're doing and then discussing it in an open, transparent forum. There's just a lot of opportunity for that today. And Chris, I mean, you've done it well personally. Now you're doing it well collaborating. You do it for your business. So do you feel like there are tentacles to your personal brand that are attached to other things, and does that get tricky, or do you still feel like you have a rather independent self, even though, you know, you've been associated with Cisco and you're associated with your consulting company and all these other details?
Oh, and I just love the word tentacles, so thanks for using that.
It's better than leak.
it's just a word that just comes out, and I don't mean to say. And I want to also say, John, too, as well, you put out it was either a blog post or a tweet or something saying, I really wish just, you know, a couple guys would get on a podcast and just talk tech for a while. You know, that's kind of a niche that no one had filled. So a couple of the episodes, that's what we're going to just do, you know. So we're using your guidance, I guess, to move us forward.
Such a smart man. Such smart guy.
When John Troyer speaks, the earth moves.
Well, no, I found myself listening to these Mac podcasts and these designer podcasts, and they'll go on for like 2 hours. It's like sitting in a coffee shop in Austin. It's really kind of boring. But they'll go on and on, and they just talk about stuff of their daily lives. And I really found it kind of fascinating. So anyway, I've appreciated it.
So, so the tentacles, Matt, actually, I don't find it a problem at all. In fact, I try to put my tentacles everywhere. You know, I want to have as much reach into everything I possibly can within the constraints of time. You know, that's really my only enemy is time.
No, and, I like it. It's like, you know, you already admitted that everyone has their preferences. So instead of going towards this angle of saying you're objective, it's like, no, you're subjective, but from as many angles as possible.
Well, I actually wanted to jump in there too. And one of the other things I wanted to cover off on is how do you avoid becoming a unicorn for hire? You know, how do you avoid that perception? How do you maintain that kind of Swiss attitude and not be seen as a paid gun?
Yeah, that's interesting. So one of the big principles that I hold to adamantly is I don't ever agree to create content. No matter where I'm at, the content is always my choice. So conferences or events or anything, if you want to invite me and pay me to come out and do whatever, you know, I might write something, I might not. And so I don't tether myself to deliverables. The
really?
Only thing I've never signed anything saying I would write something. The only time I've actually put pen to paper, you know, for contractual reasons, is if I say, okay, you want an article for, you know, a magazine or something. Obviously, there needs to be legalese there to, you know, how long it's going to be and what it's going to be about. but I've never, you know, in the past 4 years, I've not ever guaranteed a deliverable. And so that gives me the option to just do nothing if I find there's just absolutely nothing there that tickles my fancy. So far, that hasn't happened.
Well, now, and do you take briefings?
Yeah, I take a lot of vendor briefings when possible, because fortunately with, you know, internet, Skype, et cetera, it makes it pretty easy. And quite a few of them I've written nothing, just because, you know what, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
I was actually going to call that one out for any of the practitioners listening, anybody else who's doing influence marketing, that I found this to be a very common practice, and I actually really support it. Because I think what you hope to do is have an effect where if something doesn't get written, you can go back and have that honest conversation and say, hey, what did we miss? It's a real opportunity for any vendor to learn. Was it a misfire in the technology? Was it a misfire in communicating about the technology? And it is such an opportunity, as opposed to if you just pay somebody to write something and send it out the door. So I just want to say that I actually really support that mentality.
And it's interesting because people hear that, you know, I mean, yeah, I assume you have a lot of listeners. They're going to hear that and say, what, that's crazy. And, you know, I it's absolutely true. And everyone that I tell that to is just blown away. They can't imagine, you know, why would a vendor pay whatever it costs to have you come out and spend a couple of days out there if there's no payoff? And to me, to me, it's extra incentive, you know, just provide the information, let me digest it. Give me the time and you'll get something back. It's either going to be private in the form of here's my issues and I want you to know about them, or it'll be public and I'll actually, you know, the deliverable is it'll go on the blog or the YouTube channel or whatever. Hmm. And it served me well.
That's powerful.
We scare traditional marketing sometimes. I think this is part of it because it's not neat. You know, it isn't, you don't have control, but I think we've talked about this before. I think there has been, people have labored under the idea that they control the message perfectly. They no more control the message with an analyst or a publicity type event than they would in this case either. So I'm not sure why, Chris, you and your ilk, the citizen analyst is the term I like to use, why you are seen as more dangerous. But somehow, I don't know, have you encountered some of that? Have you had the marketing gloss, the fairy dust thrown at you?
Yeah, I think we're definitely considered either more dangerous or held, you know, kind of at arm's length. You can see that in many ways. I mean, the first, and this is changing. Like, I've actually really enjoyed watching this change over the last 3-4 years. Number one, as a citizen analyst, typically we're gonna get the information much closer to when it's gonna publish. So, I remember back in 2012 or so, the analysts would get information 2 to 4 weeks before it went public. Then, you know, the rags would get it maybe a week before. And then we'd get it anywhere from a day before to 1 hour before, you know, where it becomes impossible to do anything with the information and break the news in any meaningful way. And I felt that was always just because it was a little more volatile. Maybe you're an unknown quantity.
They didn't want you to leak anything.
Yeah.
But the flip side is you didn't have any time to digest anything and you couldn't actually write up anything.
Exactly. So, or they would send, you know, oh, we're in half an hour, we're going to send this. Here's the press release. Here's the PR for it, which press releases for me immediately go in the garbage. So I just don't care about
where
the press
belong.
Release. There's no meat in a press release. I can't use it for anything. It's just, you know, here's a soundbite from an executive and, you know, something's new. So,
well, Chris, by implication, that's a couple you've already mentioned a couple ways that marketing folks or PR folks should not try to engage with you, like send you a press release the day of the release. Any tips on how you like to be engaged?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting since we have – I'm going to use examples that draw from, you know, y'all with my Southern kind of leaking out there a little bit. I said leak again. I mean, first
Unicorn
off –
Unicorn just died.
Yeah, I think VMware's done a great job with the early access program. That was an example. Plenty of lead time was given. Lots of people from the VMware side reached out to me, I think, months early with, you know, here's what's going to happen at VMworld, and it's what's your schedule look like, because I don't do this for a living. I don't have Tuesday at 10 a.m. available. You know, I'm working. And so there was a lot of questions from the vendor towards me saying, what can we do to get this information to you? And if you can't make it, we'll give you a recording. And you know, there really wasn't any significant contracts to sign. It was just standard NDA. It was great. Another example, the Cisco Champions program constantly sends out, here's information in case you missed it, because I don't have time all day to watch all this stuff. Here's links to it. Use it. Don't use it. We're not going to pressure you. And if you want to use something, let us know and we'll spread the word. We'll link to you. You know, we'll make sure that you get traffic and notoriety. And I think that's great. It really helps me create content because I need time. I don't have a lot of time on my hands, and really think about what's happening with this release, whatever the technology is. And it builds trust. I think over time you just get to know, okay, I can give, you know, in the case of me, I can give Chris whatever this information is, and I know he's not going to post it early.
I think the early access program, as you describe, and really getting people to be able to be hands-on so they can have a technical discussion early in the conversation is a great approach. I think if people want to do that sort of big bang traditional marketing PR release, I'm a big fan of letting traditional marketing, traditional PR kind of handle that day of, and really owning that plus 2 weeks strategy. So I've taken that approach oftentimes and saying, you know, go out and do that day of, get that big bang. That's important. That's how you work. Be comfortable with the fact that I'm going to be developing assets and working with technologists who do need more time, and we're going to continue the conversation afterward. So we're going to let the dust settle, and then we'll keep talking to each other after the fact. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I'll jump in with the VMware strategy. Actually, that early access program is a collaboration between the social media team and the PR team, which is confused by the fact that the PR team is now calling themselves the influencer marketing team. I like that they feel like they're influencer marketers, but their influencers are actually the mostly press people, and it confuses the email threads all the time. But anyway, that's an aside. This early access program is a collaboration between us and them, and then they actually do a lot, since they're really good at logistics, and I'm like, I've got like, you know, a few hours a week to deal with it. And they actually are very good at that sort of thing. So they actually do a lot of the logistics. They bring together product marketing. We bring together tech marketing. We come up with an agenda. We come up with a series of up to sometimes for a vSphere or a vCloud Suite launch, it's like 10 hours of technical briefings. And we put everybody in the beta, and you know, we do all that. So that's actually a great example of a collaboration with PR. And they treat it completely separately than their launch day activities, like you were saying. What we don't do well, that I think EMC Elect probably does better, and it sounds like Cisco Champions does better, is that regular email newsletter.
Regular cadence.
Yeah, we're terrible at that. Again, because I just don't have the bandwidth. I'm doing a lot of the vExperts, you know. It's like, it's a half a person, so.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not at EMC anymore, but when I was running EMC Elect, we had a really clear service catalog about what different business units had to come to the table with in order for us to give them anything in the idea of results in, I will use the currency term of impressions or reach, potential reach. And that would be 7 to 10 days early access to technical deep dive content, possibly things that wouldn't be published. And it's with the express understanding that this is a trusted relationship, and if we can't build it on trust, we have nothing to ask them to do anything. You're not going to build a relationship with influencers by thinking that they're going to spill the beans on every big idea you have. You have to bring them into the circle of trust.
Yeah, and it's fun talking, like with the early access program, talking with, and I'm just using an example, I don't mean to keep picking on you, John, but there's a lot of smart people on those briefings. You know, it's technical people. It's not the sales or marketing team. It's literally product manager or person that's a sales engineer maybe. And there's the kind of people you can really ask the hard questions, and you know, you can make them accountable to get back with you. And it helps you write good content that it just sounds authentic when you write it. You can say, you know, I asked about this pain point because you know this pain point. You work in the environment all the time and you know, oh, they've included this new feature. That's going to cause a problem because of X. You know, what's the deal here? And you can cover that. And that's the value add. I'm not really, you know, as a blogger, I'm not really that interested in 0-day content, you know, breaking the news. I'm going to lose the Register and all that stuff. They're going to win. And I know that, and I'm fine with that. But being able to offer that little extra introspection where I'm looking at a product and saying, well, how am I going to use this? How are my customers going to use it? And what are they going to think? I think that's really where the value add from the blogger community is.
Yeah. When we didn't do this, that's all we got. We just got 0-day stuff. You got, you know, if you got a press release, here's the press release, here's the release notes. And that's really all you can do. So that's one of the reasons we started to do this. We also learned very early that if you have a bunch of technical bloggers, you do not set them up with most marketing managers are not the right people to talk to them. Same thing that goes on with Tech Field Day or whatever, right? You know, it's an exceptional marketing manager that actually can talk at the technical depth that's interesting. So you got to get your tech marketing folks out there or your, you know, PMs or whatever.
Yeah, you occasionally run into the, you know, the CEO that it's a startup and, you know, this guy knows all the
tech.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, but it's definitely, you know, rare to have the CEO, the CTO can go down to like the code level of some piece of hardware. So it's definitely important for this kind of audience to get someone that kind of is one of us, you know, one of us.
One of us.
It can come in and, you know, if I'm slinging acronyms and things that are related to your product, you better be able to keep up. You know, you need to be able to talk my language or else I'm going to mute it and go, you know, pet my cat.
Yes. Always recommended when blogging. They go hand in hand. But, I mean, Chris, we've been throwing a bunch of ideas your way and really appreciate getting a look into your world. What questions do you have for us, if any, as a regular listener that has some dots to connect from watching from outside? And then also just, you know, you have Cisco, you've got VMware, you have former EMC and a startup guy here. I mean, what kind of stuff are you interested in?
I love that startup guy. I love it. So, no, I'm really curious. It's going to be kind of a how the sausage is made question. And it's how difficult or what kind of challenges do you, I guess, hit when you're trying to engage the audience that is me, you know, the tech bloggers and things, especially when it revolves around, you know, releasing information that's considered sensitive. You know, what challenges arise from that?
Oh, I'll take the first one. Oh, pick me. I think the challenge is we really have to get some marketing folks on because I might take a black eye for this one. But sharing enough to make it interesting, to have marketing understand that exactly what you said, a press release is not interesting, it's not blog worthy, and that as incremental information is released, that you have to give enough of it, you have to provide enough of a roadmap, enough clarity, to be interesting, to pull the technical audience along with the conversation, and that the use are, the way I've been describing it lately, is that, and again, citizen analyst is a useful term, but I say, well, you don't buy a pair of shoes, you don't buy a book without the reviews these days, right? Even if you're in real life situation, you always look for the content that supports your choice. We all do it. We all Google it, look at reviews for whatever. And in some ways, when we're talking about these long-term purchases and these, you know, very complex buying cycles, we need those starred reviews. This content you produce is that meta layer. So we are responsible for driving that layer of conversation, that word of mouth review. And it's incredibly important. And trying to kind of translate that back to traditional marketing can be incredibly challenging because they're, you know, like, why can't we pay XYZ $10,000 and get what we want? You know, it doesn't work that way. You can't, you know, unless they want to go write fake all those word of mouth reviews themselves. And you can't even do that properly. You know, we work in a world where that's not even possible. Even if you wanted to fake that, you couldn't. I think that's the biggest challenge.
Now, Amy, so the latest stat I saw was that something like, this is some Buyer's Journey stat from Executive Council at Google or something like that, but 52 or 57% of the journey, this hypothetical model of a buyer's journey, is done pre-contacting the vendor. So from their model, you know, over half of the investigation has already been done with this kind of reviews and stuff that you've been talking about before, you know, salesman number one has been contacted. So it's backed up by studies. But don't you think that part of this too, Amy, is that your organization has to learn over time that to do this and that form relationships with these folks? Because, you know, the first time you do it, you're like, oh, what are we doing? And do you trust these people? And they're bloggers. They're like, well, wolf children, aren't they? And then over the years, you have form a relationship with them. And it's like, oh, you know, call in the. I'm trying to think of a funny metaphor. Call in the superheroes, the unicorns, yeah. And let's brief them. I mean, has that been your experience, Amy? Has it developed over time?
I think you put it really well. I think everybody's in a different stage of understanding what this looks like. And the interesting thing to me, I am org chart girl, here I go again, but I've had several great conversations this week alone with the sales team. And I used on Twitter, I said, I do think it's what we do, influence marketing, is like sales without a quota. And I love it. Somebody responded with, you know, Lisa Kaywood, I'll attribute it, you know, it is a quota, but it's it's a different kind of quota. And I think that's so well said. So I think the sales team gets what we're doing and that it takes time and that it is, it's relationships over time. I think marketing, it takes more time for them to understand this is how it works, that we can't just do this quarter to quarter. How you fund it changes. It has to be a year long or a much longer approach. You have to arm the program differently. You have to engage differently and you have to analyze the results differently. That's a huge learning curve. It's not as simple as a $40,000 for a Gartner white paper.
The sales funnel doesn't fit that anymore, where a Gartner white paper gives you enough qualified leads. And I'm getting more visibility into what it means to have a qualified lead than ever working at Infinio, just because it's so transparent with how small we are, that really the influencers, those kind of people like taking time to brief someone like Chris on a product can get you more interested potential sales that are qualified than any of these sort of analysts can at times. And yeah, that was a bit too broad stroke of a statement, but more statistically based, I think, John, you might have even underestimated, based on the HubSpot studies that are out there, about how much decisions are already baked before a vendor even gets to touch the opportunity.
Well, and to be fair, I don't want it to sound like I'm saying, let's dismiss all traditional marketing. Everybody should do influence marketing and only that. I think there's a broad spectrum approach, fully understood. But, you know, again, twofold, to understand that Chris, you and your tribe of unicorns is incredibly important and that we have to approach and engage you differently. And that to stop assigning so much hierarchical value, again, that qualified lead, people often think, oh, do they have purchasing power? Do they have a C in their title? Well, again, back to the other thing I like to say is it's not just about who makes the deal. It's also the person in the back room who can break the deal, because, you know, implementation matters. The C-levels are going to go consult with the technologists who have often done this kind of research we're talking about. They are our community. They're us. And that matters. It is a complex cycle.
Yeah, when I was in the customer space, I mean, I was a customer for well over a decade. The model was always the higher out execs, you know, the highest I ever got was like a manager, low level manager, would come down and say, you know, we need to do whatever in our data center. We need new servers. What servers should we get? And the director would say, hey, manager guy, we need some new servers. What do you think? And I would say, oh, well, I really like this server because I read, you know, Scott Lowe's blog or Eric Siebert's blog or something like that. You know, this was mid 2000s. And those are the people that drove my decisions. I had really never even heard of Gartner until later that decade. And so I definitely, that's why I'm kind of a believer of that bottom-up model. I think it works because I lived it. And that was my source of news. I read, you know, the vSphere Land top 50 blog list, and I would peruse those.
What else? What else are we doing?
I can tell you the dark side. There is a dark side.
All right, let's hear it. What's the dark side?
The dark side. Well, so there's always a twist to every engagement, and no one ever really has you there just because they like you. There's always an agenda, and this is kind of advice as well as a story. Make sure you understand why you're being invited to whatever it is and what it is that they want. And even when you have the best intentions, so I'm not going to name names, but I've written hundreds of posts, and I don't for a moment pretend to think that they all go over well. I have had a few where it's, you know, a vendor will call in and say, hey, Chris wrote a really nice article about one of our competitors. What the heck is that all about? And it'll filter down and say, well, I didn't say anything bad about the people we work with. I just said something good about this other person. And that's actually quite frequent in the grand scheme of things. You know, it happens, you know, a couple times a year. And that's just a reality. You have to be in an environment where the people that you work with, or at least the people you work with, are going to champion the fact that you're allowed to have an opinion and that it's okay to express yourself in a positive way, even if it's toward a competitor. Because otherwise, that citizen analyst, you know, you're not selling, you know, you're not a unicorn for hire, goes away. You have to be able to say good things about anybody.
It's no fun if all of a sudden some VP at a giant multi-billion dollar company who is a partner and supplier to your company, the consulting company, calls your boss or your boss's boss and starts chewing them out for something you wrote.
Yeah.
Right. Then you're not a unicorn. Then you're some sort of scapegoat, or I don't know.
Pariah.
What's the opposite of unicorn? Yeah. You have stink all over you. Now, and there is the right way to do that. So I'll tell you a story that Chris, I will anonymize it, but Chris, it's not a story about Chris, but it's a story that Chris is familiar with.
Okay.
And it's the way for a vendor. And this is the hard part. This is to the other Geek Whisperers. This is you gotta train your colleagues. Somebody writes a blog post and it is unfavorable to your product, and it might be one of these unicorns who's completely independent. But a lot of our, you know, citizen analysts work for channel partners. And what's the right thing to do? Do you go up the chain of command and have one executive, Bigfoot, you know, the channel executive? Do you have, you know, do you pick up the phone? What's your response? The bad response is to start yelling. The medium response that I don't even recommend is to pick up the phone and ask nicely, because anytime your boss is involved is a potentially like career limiting. It just makes my stomach churn, right? I do not want my boss involved in this conversation because it has nothing to do with him. If I'm a writer. But the correct thing to do, and the thing that I usually recommend doing, is one, if you have a community person, reach out. Two, get the citizen analyst back on the phone with the technical person and start the conversation over again. And say, oh, I agreed with this and this you said, but I did not agree with this and this and this, because maybe you didn't realize what we did, or this is the way we see the world, or maybe there's some NDA information I can share with you about what we're about to do. And then have a, you know, hook them up with somebody who is a resource to the citizen analyst and who can have an intelligent conversation with them, not like a bad dog you just peed in the corner again, but like, let me explain our worldview. And then all of a sudden, what you will find magically is usually the reason usually the reason that the review was unfavorable was that the person hadn't been briefed by you, right? And didn't understand. And it's just writing, it means your content marketing strategy is bad, because that writer couldn't find the material that they needed to write their blog post. I don't know. Is that... And that's a semi-true, semi-real story that I just anonymized.
John, I think you just hit it dead on perfectly that, you know, yelling when you see something that's bad, or if you find that you have the kind of boss that will just kind of call up another boss and try to have the top-down pressure.
Or even a friendly call. Still, there's like a little bit of Godfather stuff going on.
Right? Yeah. No such thing as a friendly call.
There's a unicorn head in your bed if you don't change the...
Well, no, even when Troyer calls, it's kind of a little bit of a Godfather thing going on. So even I try to be super friendly. But a call from the vendor is a call from the vendor, right?
Yeah,
it's a little
bit serious. Right. But you should remember, though, that every opportunity, that's actually a hidden opportunity, right? That if they didn't understand the vision that you laid out, maybe it's an opportunity to have a conversation and continue the dialogue. And if we're going to put our marketer hats on for any marketers out there, that's an opportunity to continue the conversation publicly that builds more reach, more impressions to an audience and keeps you in people's minds. So it's actually really kind of beneficial if you can get beyond the short transactional sense of frustration that somebody didn't see the world as you do.
Yeah, I've experienced both. You know, when I was a young unicorn grazing in the bacon fields with still sharpening my horn, I actually did have a post that came out that was a little critical on a product, and I was lucky. It was I barely put out a very small number of posts, and the vendor reached out and says, "Hey, you know what? We really think that you missed out on this one. That you don't have all the facts. Here is access to the product manager. We'd like to give you a licensing key for your whole environment for 90 days so you can try it and really get all the features that you missed out on and explore the product. And if you want, ask us any questions you want, and we'd love to see if you have a new opinion. If you don't, then you don't, and we'll move on." And I was blown away. I was like, at first I was kind of shaken, like, oh no, I pissed someone off. Because you really don't want to piss anyone off. I like being friends with everybody as much as possible. And then I've had later down, in life, I had the vendor call. It's, we would like you to take that down. And it's never fun to be told that what you wrote is so bad they don't even want it on the internet. I mean, A, that's impossible. You can't take something off the internet. And it's ignorant to think that you can. B, it just ruins that relationship. I don't even want to write about that company or vendor, whatever it is, ever again. It really upsets me deeply to think that it's just you know, if there's one sentence in there that's bad and 900 sentences that are good, you want it all gone because of that one. So definitely, to John's point, there's right ways and there's some really wrong way to do that, even if you try to be tactful, and ways that you can damage a relationship with someone that's obviously passionate enough to spend personal time writing about whatever it is.
Again, I'm going to agree with the approach pitched and well said. In the end, we're all people, and there can be, I don't know, there's a balance there, right? If we have everybody so toned down and so cowed, then we have bland conversation and don't get anywhere, and we're right back where we started. So I think the point is, you know, there are ways to write things. There are ways to disagree professionally. And I think I read a book years ago, and it's really been formative for me, called A Complaint is a Gift. And that's how I've always tried to approach and handle those situations, because sometimes you're going to disagree.
Yeah, the person, I mean, the complaint is a gift. The person cared enough to write about your product. Work with
absolutely.
That.
Jumping topics a little bit, something I'm also very interested in as we sit here on the Skype recording, Chris has a most fabulous avatar up, and it's very much part of his personal brand. Can you talk to us a little bit about some practical tips for folks listening who want to do a little bit of what you do, want to take this on, raise their hand and take a shot? You do an incredible job of personal branding. I feel like it takes you do it so well. It looks effortless. I know it's not. I mean, this is on top of, you're so organized. It's very impressive.
Yeah. It's funny. I posted a link after my 3-year anniversary writing the blog where it's the time machine showing the original blog, and it's terrible. So it's not like I woke up one day and said, I'm just going to have a huge internet presence, or, you know, what I feel is huge for me. With my own marketing thing and stickers and buttons, you know, I mean, it was a lot of error, little bit of success here and there. So what I would recommend is to start off for your brand. I mean, pick something that represents you, but hopefully still identifies with you. And by that, I mean, don't have a photo of your baby or something as your brand. You know, have something that represents you, whether that's a I guess a symbol or your face is perfectly fine. You know, that's where like I have the Simpsons character. I have my own Simpsons avatar, and it's close enough that it basically means I can never shave the goatee, but it's close enough that people at conferences can still kind of identify with me and find me without being just a headshot. And then when it comes to branding, I mean, put your stuff on everything you can think of. Put it everywhere. Everyone should think of you when they see whatever it is your brand is. So don't be shy to put it anywhere you want. Don't go tagging stop signs and stuff in San Francisco. I saw a guy doing that. That's littering. You're littering. Don't do that. But, you know, definitely pick something and stick with it. And quite frankly, I felt like when you hit a certain maturity level, and for me, it was about 2 years of blogging. So this is not an instant success kind of thing. I actually went to a service. I went to like 99 Designs and paid someone to come up with a new like logo and rebranded the site with this whole like kind of mentality of, you know what, everything I do, every social media platform, every sucker on my tentacle, for Matt's expression there, that is being touched will have a certain color scheme, the image, and just go with it and own it and be snazzy with it because it's yours, baby, you know? So
love it.
I guess that's the branding advice that I would give. And don't expect, how do I say this? Don't expect anyone to recognize it anytime soon because, you know, you're not Coca-Cola or something like that. It's not like people are going to see it and be like, oh yeah. And that's a mistake I made. So I actually produced buttons that had just the logo on it after less than a year. And everyone's like, which way do you pin this on your jacket? What, you know, what is this thing? And so there's definitely mistakes that you can make where you think your branding is better than it is. So I don't know, right in the middle somewhere of pushing the logo versus not on all your stuff.
It's fair. And then just, and also you're a 3-year overnight success. Boom.
Yeah. A lot of people say, I started a blog and only 8 people read it. It's like, well,
it's like 7 doing, more than me at the beginning.
Yeah, come you're on. Doing 3 times more than I did when I started a blog. In fact, I remember being excited. So I started blogging in 2010, and I got excited because I think after 8 months or so, I finally had 100 people read the entire site in a month. I was like, wow, I broke 100. That's amazing. And that's just what it was. It was just a place where I wrote down, you know, random thoughts and things like that. And then over time, I got a lot more serious about it.
And let's take off our big jaded social media guru hats here, all of us, and think about it, right? I've got like, I don't know, 10,000 followers on Twitter or something like that. That's crazy. Like, and I don't know how many thousand people you have coming to your blog. It's really hard to get 100 people in a room, right? And I know that it's not the same thing, da da da. But that's pretty cool that you can reach out and touch that many people. That's awesome.
It's incredibly cool, and I would tie it back to what we've talked about before with the concept of influenced diet. You know, there is no shortcut. So I feel like, Chris, your story is fantastic because we can see the success that you are now. It didn't happen immediately. It was work. So it's work you love and you've continued to do. But I think in the end, it's influence is built over time and by showing up and by doing the quality work that you do and by making mistakes and correcting them and continuing to learn.
Yeah, definitely. I think you hit on one of the more important aspects to, I guess, getting your content out there is producing lots of content. You know, it's kind of like a dartboard. The more you throw at it, eventually you're going to hit something near the bullseye and Google picks it up and SEO does the rest. And having routine content showing that you're willing to, you know, I guess stick with it. You're not a fly by night, you know, you're not going to come in and out. Is probably the most crucial thing about it. And a lot of people will kind of ask me, well, you know, what do you write about? How do you think of topics? To be honest, you know, you just write 1,000 draft posts that are just a title of, you know, I had one that was like, talk about nachos. It was literally a blog post I was working on. I just said, talk about nachos. And And then later, like a couple days later, I'm like, yeah, I was going to write about something about nachos. And I'm like, oh, you know, I'm writing about this, how I think IT should be consumable like nachos. And so you just have these little like 2 a.m. you wake up kind of ideas and just write about all of them. 200 words, 1,000 words, doesn't matter. Just put your thoughts down and people will either like it or they won't. And if they don't, screw them. Just keep writing as long as you enjoy it.
Chris, really appreciate you coming on. It's been an incredible episode. It's a lot of fun to hear about the mechanics behind the curtain.
No problem. This will be the only episode that I don't listen to because I hate hearing myself. So.
I'll make sure I tweet bomb you with little audio clips then.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
So when you're not coming up with ideas, you know, in your sleep, where can people find you?
Certainly. So pretty much the two places I would advise is on the blog, wallnetwork.com, and on the Twitters, I'm at Chris Wahl.
Awesome.
W-A-H-L.
Yeah, like the shaving company that stole the original blog I wanted was wall.com, and those bastards with their giant corporation stole my website. So
was Walmart also taken?
But on the bright side, I think of you every time I shave.
Yeah, I only buy Wahl branded facial pruning equipment.
Pruning?
Like, whose is that? It's mine, of course. It has my name on it.
So. Coincidence?
I think How not. Else do I manscape, you know?
Well, this is degenerated.
Before there's an accident, I'm going to, you know, sign us out. So thanks for listening. This has been the Geek Whisperers.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as Jay Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.
It's like, oh my gosh.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Yeah.
So you're up, Amy.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're
I'll
the unicorn herder.
Unicorn herder it is.
Called ourselves a unicorn.
Yes.
I'm in it just for the Amy snorts.